There's my music. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Returning is Veronica Monet, my guest, and she was on my program around Thanksgiving of last year. Veronica is a relationship coach. You can find her at theshamefreezone.com. And what we talked about last fall was how from 1989 to 2004, she was a high-end escort who catered to wealthy businessmen. And we talked about what she learned about men while working as an escort. We're shifting today's topics a bit. Stay tuned because they're still very fascinating. Claiming your erotic birthright as a woman. Now, there are lots of messages in this program for men, too. So I want, no matter what your gender is, to stay tuned. Welcome once again to this program, Veronica. I'm not hearing you. Maybe Kelsey needs to, our producer needs to get you in. Well, I will continue to talk until I hear Veronica. So
I can hear you, Dr. Diana.
Oh, good. Okay, well, then I think everybody's hearing you. Good. Hello,
okay,
Veronica.
Good.
So we're going to talk about, you have an ongoing program claiming your erotic birthright as a woman. And so today, in the East, it's this evening. Here on the West Coast, it's late afternoon. We're going to focus on codependency. This is a big problem for lots of women and some men, but more women. We're going to focus on body image, body shame. Again, more women than men suffer from this. And then we're going to look at the divine feminine and what that means. But again, I just feel like men need to listen in, because the more you know about a woman, the more likely you are to have pleasure with her and be a good partner for her. Wouldn't you say, Veronica?
You know, what's more important to me about men is that if they are connected to their own divine feminine essence, they're going to be happier, more whole human beings.
Well, so, say a little more about that. That's very good.
Yeah, I think we're at a time historically mm-hmm. where the masculine is so out of balance. And if we just think of a masculine and feminine being attached to our gender identity, then we kind of miss the whole point, because mm-hmm. men and women and people of all genders have masculine and feminine aspects to themselves. And we are all a little too out of balance with the masculine energy right now. A lot of the women that I work with are out of balance around their sexuality because they're trying to conform to a masculine template for sex. And a lot of men that I work with are out of balance because they don't have much connection to their feminine aspect. They don't know how to process emotions except for anger. And even sometimes their sex comes across as rushed and angry, and therefore not very pleasurable for them. So we are all suffering. The planet is suffering because of this lack of connection with the divine feminine,
which we're going to talk about, the divine feminine. But in our pre-interview yesterday, we thought we'd start with codependency, which is a big problem, and then go on to body image, as I said at the top of the show, and then conclude this show with the divine feminine. And you're going to return for a part two, I want to say May 30th. I don't have my calendar in front of me, but it's about 3 weeks from today,
yep.
So that'll be good.
Yes. Absolutely.
Excellent. So codependency, you see this a lot. So do I, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
codependency is a little misunderstood.
Yeah.
People often think that it is a more feminine trait, that it's mm-hmm. about kind of trying to placate or people please. And mm-hmm. that's one aspect of codependency. But the other side of that coin is about being controlling. Mm-hmm. They're both codependent. In fact, just about the most codependent act I think I've ever heard of being committed is when the woman leaves the boyfriend or the husband who's been battering her, and he chases her down, shoots her dead, and then puts a bullet through his own brain. That is the most extreme expression of codependency that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're quite literally saying that you don't know how to live with this other person. Codependents a lot of times are looking for another human being to feel superior to. And it gives them something to think about besides how much they hate themselves. So that's one of the big glaring myths about codependency. People think, well, I'm not codependent because I'm in charge. And it's like, no, if you have an overarching need to control, then you are codependent.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I have seen in my client population that control freaks micromanage, give unsolicited advice, often voice strong opinions, often relentlessly, and are rarely satisfied.
Yes. The one that most of us is familiar with is kind of more of the nagging mother paradigm, where it's like, after all I've done for you, you're so ungrateful. So there's obviously different ways of expressing this, but what they all have in common is an inability to function in a satisfying way in relationship to others and also independent of others. So we're looking for a healthy model where you've got boundaries, you know where you end and begin and where the other person ends and begins. You can let go and detach when other people are not doing what you want them to do. And you can assert healthy boundaries for yourself so that you're taking care of yourself. All of that stuff is not only difficult, hard work to learn how to do, but it's not really built into our current cultural paradigm. So most of us learned how to be codependent from our parents, our popular movies, and our songs. I mean, and from the dating world and from our friends. It's mm-hmm. just like that's the standard, is to be codependent. And codependency usually leads to a certain level of dishonesty because people are being manipulative. So you see this in a lot of movies, you know, where it's supposed to be funny that they're lying to each other. Mm-hmm. But it's not funny. It's actually a very dysfunctional pattern, because if you move away from codependency, then you have the integrity to tell your truth in ways that are not going to be hurtful to others. And that's a whole art form there. But, you know, who's teaching that? Not a lot of people are teaching
not
that.
Not a lot of people. Sometimes I say to clients, I want you to consider the difference between want and need. And if you're serious about somebody or you're in a relationship with somebody already, ideally you should be able to say, you know, I really want you even more than I need you. And that is to say, I can live without you, but I can live better with you. So, and
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I've also worked with some compulsive overeaters, and they're often people pleasers who have difficulty saying no. And I suggest that they practice saying no, and that indeed the universe will not stop spinning if they say no to a request, for instance. And I've had some compulsive overeaters who will, late at night, after giving all day to their significant other and their families and so on, they'll stand up eating over the sink, kind of like giving back to themselves, finally, with food as comfort. And that's of course, not very healthy, not only for the body, but for the soul.
Well, certainly, we have to learn how to give to ourselves and to give to ourselves in a way that's life-giving and life-affirming.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's all kinds of things that happen, too. I mean, we could look at the guy who has to have, you know, 4 or 5 beers every time he comes home because he's not able to feel satisfied in his life. There's a way in which he's working a job that he may hate in order mm-hmm. to support a family that he feels disconnected from. And so there's codependency in that as well. There's a way in which we're not taking care of ourselves. And we're not encouraged to. The culture is kind of workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
And workaholism, eating disorders, television addiction, those things are all, you know, they're isms that can be related to codependency. They're certainly an indication that we're out of balance and not in a healthy relationship with ourselves and others. So, yeah, it's really, really important to be able to say no to certain things and certain people, and it's really important to learn how to be able to say yes to ourselves. I do think that when it comes to pleasure, this is particularly problematic for women, and I'm not just talking about sexual pleasure. I'm just talking about the pleasures of spare time, the pleasure of a particular sport or hobby, the pleasure maybe of pampering ourselves. Like a lot of women, I think, have a hard time. If they live in alone, they have a hard time preparing a meal for themselves. One, you know, like doing gourmet cooking for themselves.
Uh-huh, yes.
It's something they've learned to do for others.
Good point.
Yeah. Yeah. So
because if a woman lives alone and perhaps doesn't have a partner, she can cultivate giving to herself by cooking well for herself, by self-stimulation, because having orgasms is so healthy for her. It might have a little more health benefit when she's with a partner, but still there are benefits when she's making love to herself.
Absolutely. I think it's mm-hmm. particularly crucial that women learn how to self-pleasure mm-hmm. sexually because the female body is such a mysterious, complex creature full of wonderful gifts and beautiful vistas that, you know, if you don't take the time, the luxurious time, and have the patience to explore that, there's so much of that symphony that you're going to miss, that you're not going to experience. And it's one of the greatest joys of being in a female body, is learning all the ways that it can produce pleasure.
Yes, and I read recently that the clitoris can actually enlarge as a woman ages. And the clitoris is only function, of course, is for pleasure, around 8,000 nerve fibers. The G-spot may be the root of the clitoris. And, so when women get past procreation, they can get more into just enjoying the joy and the pleasures.
As you and I discussed this in our pre-interview, and it is exactly what I'm teaching in my class, and
mm-hmm.
and there's really nobody that's teaching this yet, but there's so many people that are really focused on reclaiming female sexual pleasure after menopause, and
mm-hmm.
I am not on a mission to reclaim anything. I am on a mission to forge ahead into unknown territory so that postmenopausal women, I think, are really, their bodies are giving them signals that sex is no longer going to be procreative. It is now going to be pleasure-based, and more pleasure-based than before, not just as pleasure-based as before, more pleasure-based than ever before. And I think that if the clitoris wasn't growing, then maybe that would not be such a plain message. But it's quite obvious to me that that is, in fact, what the body's trying to say. We're shutting down the ovaries now, mm-hmm. and we are going to transfer our energy to the clitoris, which is the only organ in the human body which has one sole purpose, and that purpose is to create pleasure.
To create pleasure.
It's really just an exciting time for women sexually to move into that. And I know from myself and my own journey around this postmenopausally, it's not just that I have learned to play with energy, which I have, and it's not just that I'm having kundalini orgasms that are off the charts, which I am, but my body is also doing things that I could not and never did do before I went through menopause. So there's been like this amazing jump, this amazing leap into a world of sexual pleasure that I didn't even know existed. And for, just to give you, for instance, I ejaculate larger quantities of Amrita than I ever did before menopause. My clitoris is larger than it was before menopause. Mm-hmm. And I'm capable of having longer and more more distinct orgasms, and I've also really been exploring this A spot, the anterior fornix erogenous zone, which is just located at the tip of the cervix towards the belly. So that's the anterior wall of the vagina. It's similar to a G spot, but it's further up inside.
Uh-huh. Yes.
This is a part of the anatomy that some women can stimulate if they're anorgasmic, in other words, unable to achieve an orgasm. They can achieve an orgasm by stimulating this part of the body. And it's also a place where women are having trouble lubricating can sometimes evoke more pleasure, and the body will start lubricating more. So it's a particularly potent place for postmenopausal women to explore, and I usually recommend that they get a slender, waterproof G-spot stimulator, because they don't actually make A-spot stimulators yet. Hopefully we'll get the sex toy industry clued in on this at some point. But right now, it's just get a long, slender G-spot stimulator. You can go up in there. And that spot is full of emotions. It's where a lot of our sexual trauma is stored. Mm. So one of the first things you have to do is you have to just like really be sensitive and gentle and which really is a feminine energy, bringing in a lot of yin to gently tease out the feelings and the emotions that are hidden in there. And if you have to cry, cry. If you have to get angry, get angry. On the other side of that is a tremendous amount of pleasure waiting for you.
But first things first, you may have to go through this range of emotions as you just described. And sometimes it can be very useful to see somebody like you, a coach, somebody like me, a therapist. There are groups for women. It depends on where you live. I would suggest the website ASECT.com. ASECT stands for... It's AASECT, American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Teachers, and you can plug in where you live and find a sex therapist in your area, usually.
You know, there's also another resource that's really valuable.
Yeah,
My friend and colleague Joseph Kramer started something called the Sexological Body Worker Program, and it's a certification program. It was started in the state of California. Now it exists throughout the world. Sexological body workers actually learn how to touch penises and vaginas in a way that releases sexual trauma. It's specifically designed for that, and I've had a sexological body work session. I highly recommend it, especially if you've ever survived a rape, a date rape, even sexual harassment. I mean, there's ways in which women can just start to contract energetically Or take this for instance, having sex with your husband when you didn't really want to, but you felt like you had to or you should, mm-hmm. which is this, you know, takes us back to codependency, right? Not being mm-hmm. able to say no when you want to say no to people that you love. But that the tension that can be in the genitals because of having sex that was unpleasant or felt obligatory can also yeah. need to be brought out therapeutically. And if you see a sexological body worker, they're actually able to use touch just very much like a massage therapist does, only to help you process the emotions around that trauma and free yourself up so you can move into a place that's more pleasure-based.
Yes, it's been a while, but I had Dr. Charlie Glickman on my program, and he does sexological body work. And what do you know the website for that, Veronica?
It's actually just sexologicalbodywork.org, I believe. And
okay.
if it's not, you can put it in your browser. And Charlie's a good friend of mine, too. I used
yeah,
to
good.
Actually, I was sitting in a sex educator salon 20 years ago with him and Joseph Kramer when Joseph said he was going to found Sexological Body Worker.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Kramer is still quite active, isn't he?
You know, I'm not entirely up on
yeah.
what he's doing right this minute. He's been
right.
incredibly prolific because he started off with Body Electric and then went to Sexological
Body
Worker.
Right.
I think he's doing videos now, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of body electric, let's move on to body image. And because so many women in particular have body shame, and I know you work with lots of women, so do I, who have body shame. And last month, not quite a month ago, I was published in the Huffington Post, and it was myths that sex therapists encounter. And mine was, my myth was number 3 on the list, and I'll just read it because I have it in front of me. You have to feel hot enough to truly enjoy sex. And then I wrote, media and porn may be to blame for women believing that they have to have a beautiful body to be alluring and enjoy sex. Typically, men don't notice women's physical flaws. All they think is, oh, my God, a naked woman is near me. And I've suggested to my female clients that no matter what they look like, if they love their body, men will too. This may require cultivating an appreciation for her uniqueness. When she can start to appreciate her imperfections as endearing distinctions, she will have begun to love herself in a way that allows her to love others. So that's what I wrote for Huffington Post. They apparently liked it sufficiently that they published it along with some other sex therapists who had other myths. So, but body image, I've dealt with that for the 30 plus years I've been doing this work. It's very prevalent. And in our pre-interview yesterday, you have a history of body image that is fascinating. Would you share that with our listeners?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And then I'd
mm-hmm.
love to share how it is that I work around body image with women. First of all, I just want to say that body image is an issue for men as well, increasingly
yes.
so. There are lots of young men that are starting to develop addictions to anabolic steroids as well as eating disorders because the media has really been promoting lots of images of guys with ripped abs. So there's a lot of guys out there now trying to get ripped abs, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
they're endangering their health to do it. And women also endanger their health trying to look a particular way. Now,
mm-hmm.
now how a woman wants to look has always been constrained by society. So, but before I go into that, yes, my history is rather unique because my mother is very, very slender.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, she's beyond slender. She's skinny.
Mm-hmm.
And my father berated her for that
oh,
and
really?
Didn't like Yeah, he did. So because I took after her genetically, my father berated me the entire time that I was growing up. He called me too skinny and flat-chested, told me no man would ever want me because I was skinny and flat-chested. So towards the end of my adolescence, I worked really, really hard to put on 5 pounds. It took me an entire year to gain 5 pounds. And I worked so hard, and I was so proud of myself when I finally got those extra 5 pounds on, because I noticed that the boys were noticing me. They were more attracted to me because I had a little curve to me. And then I moved from the state of Oregon to the state of California, and I went to apply for a job as a fitness trainer. And the fitness trainer had a completely different viewpoint. He thought I needed to lose 10 pounds and get a tan. So I went to the state of Oregon, which thought I was too skinny and was making fun of me and not attracted to me, to the state of California, which had a completely different standard. And then well, I stayed in California, so that launched me into my years of anorexia, where I just lived off of caffeine, cocaine, and cigarettes.
So healthy for you, dear Veronica.
That was pretty horrible I did to myself. I actually damaged my health quite a bit. I didn't know that I was doing it at the time, but I wound up with some erosion of my gums and also bones. So I've had, you know, that journey with an eating disorder. And it's always been on the anorexic side of things, even, you know, except for those years that I was trying to put weight on. It was obvious that that was a very difficult thing for me to do at that time. So anyhow, here's what I learned about this whole thing. At some point, it was really obvious to me. Here, I had bent over backwards to try to please my father, who wanted me to weigh more. And then I bent over backwards to please the trainer. I didn't even want a job with him. I just wanted to fit in with whatever he thought I should look like. And I ended up feeling, as an anorexic, that I just couldn't be skinny enough. I always felt fat. It's astounding, actually, just how much charge there is on women's bodies. If you look at it historically, in the Renaissance period, you know, we go through a period where women are meant to have kind of white skin, and they need to be opulent. We need to have lots of curves on them. So if you look at the Rubenesque period in art, the women all have a lot of folds of skin on their bellies, and their thighs are rather, you know, large. And that was considered the feminine ideal. Interesting, aside, most of the women who posed for those photos were actually prostitutes, because those were the only women who would take their clothes off for a painter.
In those times, and Ruben painted a lot of the women, thus we have the term Rubenesque.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that standard had classism attached to it, and this is what was going on at the time. The higher ranking people had other people, the peasantry, if you will, to work in the fields for them. So this work in the fields was identified with a tan and with being lean and muscular. And if you had extra weight on you, it meant that you were wealthy, or you had good breeding, you came from royalty, so you could afford to have a little more food than your body actually needed to function, and so it would put on a little extra weight. And then you would carry a parasol and stay out of the sun, because you did not want to be associated with the peasantry.
Right.
Now, you fast forward to the industrial age. The industrial age, our poor people wind up working in factories. They are working away from the sun, and they are working on assembly lines. They have a limited budget, and the food that they can afford is highly processed. So they don't have as much access to organic or even just fresh fruits and vegetables. Matter of fact, if you go into some inner city areas, you can't find a tomato within a 10-mile radius. So
you're saying currently, this, we're not even going back in history.
Well, yeah, it's still a case.
Yeah.
It's still the case. So, but it starts in the industrial age. So people who don't have money don't have tans, and they have extra weight on their bodies. And the people who have money are now flying off to the Caribbean or some other location to sun themselves on the bow of a yacht or on a fancy, you know, expensive beach resort somewhere, and they're eating their vegetables, and they got their personal trainers. So we switched the classes. Value about what is a beautiful body, and the way in which that's so arbitrary and capricious and is based really on class issues, I think this is such an important thing for every woman to educate herself to, so that she no longer has to say things like, I don't have to be beautiful in order to be sexy. Beauty is not a static quantity. You get to decide what's beautiful. You get to decide what's beautiful instead of allowing the media and the dominant culture and class issues to tell you what it is. And we see this now changing with a multiracial culture, which is introducing different body types, different hair types, and different skin colors. And we're starting to see a broadening of what it is we consider beautiful. And I'm just really celebrating that, because I think there is beauty all around us. But if we allow these this training that we have, which is unfortunately really about class issues and racism, to define what beauty is, then we're missing the diversity of beauty. And there's
a lot
of it.
We're missing the diversity of beauty. And when in our pre-interview yesterday, you also talked about some of the issues with the hijab, and please don't kill me. Expand on that. Expand on that, because it's really relevant today with what President Trump is saying, and it's just such a mess.
Well, you know, we're at an incredibly interesting time in history where women's bodies are so politicized. So, you know, aside from the whole idea of abortion and birth control and whether or not women are going to get access to that, we've also got this focus on what they are allowed to wear and what they should not wear. So my friend and I thought, wouldn't it be something we just start a movement for women that would say, please don't kill me? And so basically, if I'm in the United States and I'm wearing a hijab, please don't kill me. And if I happen to be in the Middle East and I'm wearing a miniskirt, please don't kill me.
Exactly.
Because it highlights the how arbitrary and yet how deadly that message is. How deadly that message is, that we are going to take women's choices away from them, so that women are not allowed to wear what they want to wear. Women are not allowed to have sex the way they want to have it. Women are not allowed to control their reproductive choices, and women are not allowed to have whatever type of body they want to have. And I really want to encourage women to choose what they like. You know, choose a body you like living in. Choose a body that, and then, you know, okay, some people say you don't have a choice. Well, there's some truth to that. I can't change my height no matter what I do. But we do have a lot of educational resources available to us now about what we can do with our bodies to make them the best healthy expression of what we were born with. And that, I think, is what's most important, is are you healthy?
Are you healthy, and can you appreciate that maybe your chubby thighs, because a lot of women have problems with that, actually take you places. Your legs work well. That may be a sagging breast. Perhaps the woman has breastfed her babies, and that's been very functional. To appreciate what they have and how their bodies work. And as I said earlier, most men really are not as critical as women think they'll be. I want to quote Robert De Niro, and he said, according to a new survey, women say they feel more comfortable undressing in front of men than they do undressing in front of other women. They say that women are just too judgmental, where, of course, men are just grateful.
Yes,
Women have this idea that other women are just so judgmental because they're judgmental about themselves. Most men are very, you know, some of the younger listeners may not know about Marlene Dietrich. I bet you do, because she was in a beautiful actress with long legs from the 20s and 30s. A lot of movies, and she said the average man is more interested in a woman who is interested in him than he is in a woman with beautiful legs. She knew.
I've not really asked that familiar. I've heard her name, but of the 20s and 30s is well before my time, so I'm not that familiar with her. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, they insured her legs. Is that what happened?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They insured her legs, and she was just a beautiful woman with these long legs, and I think she was very wise when she said that the average man is more interested in a woman who is interested in him, right?
Well, since we're topic today is about codependency, I think it's real important for women to stop worrying about what men like.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so much more interesting to me what I like. And this is what I'm really wanting to help the women that I work with to move away from. What do men want? I don't care what men want. What do you want? What do you mm-hmm. want as a woman? What kind of a body do you like living in? And what do you enjoy about being physical? What would bring you the most pleasure and the most joy? Those are the sort of questions that are more interesting to me than what men are attracted to. I think it's much more interesting what the woman herself is attracted to, so that she's choosing clothing that makes her feel good, and she's choosing a hairstyle that she enjoys, and she's deciding if and when she's going to wear makeup for herself, not for anybody else. And that to me is like moving into a place of self-determination and empowerment. And
self-determination, yes.
Yeah, and I think that when we start deciding what we like instead of allowing the media to tell us what we should like, and mm-hmm. and instead of worrying about what men like, I just think that's a really, really powerful place to come from, and a much more satisfying place to come from, and also a much less codependent place to come from.
Mm-hmm. But it is so ingrained. Now, you probably remember Erica Jong starting in 1973 mm. when she published Fear of Flying.
I was 13 in 1973, so
okay.
I'm sorry. I missed her book.
Yeah. Oh, but it's still, it's in millions of copies worldwide. And I remember I was older than you when it came out. And
what
I remember thinking, what?
What was the name of her book?
Fear of Flying.
Fear of Flying, okay.
And yeah, she has many books, and I've read, I think, most of them. I just think she's an amazing woman. And so here was her observation when it comes to body image. And she said, many women think they're ugly, even very pretty women. and a man who understands this could get laid a lot. Women find faults with their figures and on and on and on, and women worry all the time. And then Judith Viorst, who has written some wonderful poems, she added to this theme by saying in her poem, "It's hard to be devil-may-care when there are pleats in your derriere. It's hard to surrender to sin when trying to hold your stomach in." So I just, you know, it helps if you can bring in a little humor to all of this, right?
Humor is always a good thing.
No, it's a good thing to be able to, and to have self-effacing humor. That's always a sign of good health. You can make fun of yourself.
I think that young women today are really moving into a place where they are interested in telling the truth about themselves. I see a lot of young women that are posting pictures on Instagram just celebrating the reality of their bodies and really rejecting the media's in the past, they were photoshopping pictures so that the pictures didn't even reflect what was physically, humanly possible for a body to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really changing fast because so many women have rejected that. And I think that's just, I think it's great. I love what I see, the ways in which women are starting to affect the culture and starting to affect commerce because, you know, we really do control a lot of the spending. and if you can change that messaging, then the next generation that comes up after that is even less oppressed by some of this nonsense. And really, it's nonsense because when it comes to women's sexuality, it's not about what we look like. It's about how we feel in our hearts, how we feel in our minds, how we feel in our souls, how we feel in our bodies. And unfortunately, we've spent so much time looking at the exterior, and we do this to both men and women in all genders. There's plenty of people who are not male or female, and that is actually becoming a case now where 25% of millennials don't even consider themselves male or female, so I don't want to leave them out of this conversation.
But I think it's important for me to share with you and the listeners a survey of 3,627 women who found that those who were most satisfied with their bodies, regardless of their looks or shape, made love more often, reached orgasm more frequently, and were more confident about pleasing their mates. So, you know, that's pretty important that women are comfortable and happy with how they look, regardless of their shape. And they have a certain self-confidence, body confidence, sexual confidence that others can feel, particularly a male partner or a female partner for that matter.
Right. So
yeah.
I think that it's really important to get away from some of what has happened. I've seen with people, you know, unfortunately, almost everybody gets their sex education from pornography now. Most boys, by the time they're 11, will have seen pornography. And I think the statistic is real similar for girls, maybe 12 to 13. And the pornography that's out there is so degrading towards women. It's not embracing a female pleasure at all. A lot of what's out there is actually pretty violent, and I don't mean in the good type of violence. You know, like BDSM, which is there's lots of beautiful people doing BDSM. I'm talking about the kind of violence that tries to look like rape.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of it out there.
But honestly, porn. But Veronica, most porn does not portray violence. between men and women. Most porn does not. That which does is, of course, very harmful.
You and I will have to disagree about that because what I have seen, if you just do a very simple search online, is not the case. But here's what I want to say about that is that getting your education from pornography is the worst place in the world to do it. And
I agree with.
Because it's not at all realistic about female sexual response at all. Ejaculating on a woman's back is not going to make her come.
No.
Jessica Drake has been on my radio show, and she actually launched an entire educational line, explicit videos about how to have different types of sex, anal sex, fellatio, cunnilingus, intercourse, et cetera, because she was horrified. She'd been in all these mainstream videos, and the anal sex scenes were, of course, edited, heavily edited. And then women would come up to her and say, I'm trying to do what I saw you do in that film, and it hurt, and it didn't work, and I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong. And she was so horrified that she said, okay, I'm going to start Wicked Pictures, and I'm going to teach women how it actually is. Mm-hmm. So she brought in a bunch of couples to talk about it and discuss the ins and outs of it. And, of course, the fact that, you know, so much of what was essential to a pleasurable experience was edited out and wound up on the cutting room floor.
Yes.
So, but what I deal with my client base are a lot of women who are trying to emulate what they've seen in the pornography films. And I, you know, just in case your listening audience thinks I'm anti-porn, I've actually produced and appeared in pornography myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you
come across as anti-porn at all. And, of course, I am in total agreement with you that porn is the worst sex educator possible. It does not teach slow, sensual sex. And so many men would do better if they'd swap their porn movies for a bottle of massage oil and take the time massaging.
I like that. That's a great line. You should tweet that.
Trading
your pornography for a bottle of massage oil.
And of course, I give as homework assignments to a lot of my couples, caressing exercises, sensei focus, that for the first couple of weeks, intercourse isn't even allowed, so it helps couples get in touch with all the other erotic possibilities in their bodies
from the top
of their head.
Isn't that a wonderful? That's a wonderful piece of homework. Masters and Johnson's developed back in the 70s. I rely on it a lot too.
Give it
to a lot of my clients.
Right, because Masters and Johnson felt that too many people were too genitally focused, and there are all these other erotic possibilities. From the very top of our heads to the bottom of our feet.
And that is
too many people get stuck between the legs, you know?
It's true for men as well. And there's so many, you know, I've talked to women about, you know, what kind of foreplay do you do? And they're like, well, I go down on him. And I'm like, excuse me?
Yeah.
That's your idea of foreplay is to give him a blowjob. No.
What is she getting?
What about his ears? What about his neck? What about the insides of his thighs? What about his perineum? I mean, what about his nipples? So much to a man besides his penis.
Of course, the problem is that too many men are too penis-centric. It's all about the penis, and they need to be educated, and that's what these exercises can do for men and for women to find out that there are all these other pleasurable centers.
And that kind of brings us back to the final topic that you wanted to cover, which was the divine feminine.
We'll do that, but since we're going to do, we will do that, and but since we're going to have another show. On the 30th, we'll perhaps talk more about that as well. So, but let's make a beginning on the divine feminine because that's a big part of your workshop, birthing the divine feminine in you while balancing your masculine and feminine energies. So expand on that, dear Veronica.
Well, first of all, I just want to talk about how this applies to men. Because the idea that a man is penile-centric, that he's just thinking about his genitals when he thinks about sex, is to me such a horrible shortchanging of the male seat of pleasure. The male ability to orgasm and to enjoy intimacy is really truncated by that. And so to engage the entire man instead of just that part of the man is to take him to new heights that he never imagined possible. You know, I've talked to so many men who've been so jealous of how their girlfriend or their wife is able to orgasm and have multiple orgasms and felt like, what would it be like to have an all-over body orgasm? What would it be like to have multiple orgasms? I only wish I was a woman so I could find out. And I said, well, actually, men can do that too. Do you want me to show you how? Because the human body, regardless of gender, is capable of so much pleasure. But we can't get to it if we are all yang. And yang or yang energy is the masculine. Mm-hmm. And if that's the only energy that you're running, you just cannot access that other level of pleasure. So
right.
you have to pull in the yin or the feminine. And I like the divine feminine archetype because I just really think that that's what's rising on the planet right now. I think it's we've got women are rising. We've got a way in which we're trying to reclaim the environment and show respect towards Mother Earth. This to me is all kind of coming from the same thing. But this is about men just as much as it's about women. Mm-hmm. And maybe more so in some ways, because I don't think men understand just how much they're suffering when they don't have this balance of feminine energy. And I'm really interested in helping to bring that out for all genders, for all people to know that to have that feminine energy is a huge gift and a huge rebirthing. Now, I'm speaking from experience here because I was raised very male-identified. I'm cisgender. I was born female. But my father, my father had a lot of problems. But I think he wanted a boy, and so he raised me very much like a boy. Mm-hmm. And in our home, we're not allowed to cry. We were really the only emotion we were allowed to was either submission or anger. Anyway. So I had to learn how to cry, how to be more subtle, and I'm still working on bringing in more yin energy because I definitely gravitate towards more masculine expressions and more yang. And I have found that the more I learn how to slow down, the more I learn how to bring in that yin, the more subtle I become and the more I'm able to tap into all these layers of pleasure. And I've certainly taught this to my clients too. And in my former profession as well as this one, bringing that to men has been a huge learning journey for me. Just watching and learning how much pleasure men's bodies are capable of if they learn how to breathe and slow down and access all of their erogenous zones instead of just rushing to the finish line.
It's so very, very true. And so if you get into the Tantra yoga tradition, sex is the life energy that flows through the body and its energy centers or the chakras, the heart, the head, the pelvis, and so on. And, couples can learn to channel this energy and and then ride it to maximum pleasure. And I've quoted my fiance Brian before, but he really has brought out the goddess in me, and because he has a saying which I really love, and it is this: worship your woman, and the goddess will reward you. And honestly, I just feel so fortunate to have a man in my life with that attitude. Because, you know, it's in Tantra, it's often the man's job to give pleasure and the woman's to let go and let the goddess out. And and of course, a lot of men are asking themselves, how am I doing, you know, the performance thing. And the woman will be asking, how do I look, you know, the body image thing that we've been talking about.
So, well, that's true. That is the default setting for those two genders.
Mm-hmm. The default setting.
Absolutely. It's the default setting.
So, dear Veronica, we're going to wind this show down, but we will have a good time in the next show on the 30th talking about other aspects of your workshop called Claiming Your Erotic Birthright as a Woman. And so we'll talk about other aspects of that. But tell our listeners how they can reach you, because you do coaching online, or how do you do it?
I'm sitting in my office right now in Northern California, which is Nevada City. But if they happen to not be around here, which is very likely, then they can. Tomorrow, I will be working with a couple via Skype, and I also use Zoom. So we just log onto our computers and we coach via video, which is awesome. It really works really, really well, and I love it. And then the telephone too. Sometimes it's just easier for all concerned. We can't get to our computers because of our schedules, and we work over the phone.
Right. Right.
So those is really the two. The two ways that I work, and the best way for them to reach me is to either go to my website, which is www.theshamefreezone.com. That's theshamefreezone.com. And or they can also email me, Veronica@theshamefreezone.com.
Okay.
And I also accept text messages, so people can text me. I know this is taking a risk here, putting this out on the radio, but I found actually people only do it usually if they've got something valid,
Veronica,
to share.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that because that's the music and that means I have to stop.
Alrighty.
But thank you. We'll continue this fascinating, provocative conversation on May 30th. So I look forward to that. Thank you so much for this wonderful hour. Appreciate it, Veronica.
Bye.
Thank
you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.